You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 13th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy International Left-Handers Day to everyone.
Shut up.
Hey, I'm left-handed.
Well, happy International Day, Jay.
Happy you day, I guess.
What do I get?
You get to not be burned at the stake for being a witch.
For being sinister.
For using your sinister hand.
And Jay, this is 2 days after your 40th birthday, so happy birthday, Jay.
Hey, happy birthday, Jay.
All right.
Thank you, thank you. You know, when I've turned 30, I actually was like a little upset, and I was a little anxious, and I don't know. I turned 40, it was non-eventful. I just didn't care.
Right.
Isn't that strange?
No.
You're older now. You realize that.
Yeah, you're wiser.
You're demented, and
death's inevitable.
I don't feel 40
either.
But
he's still really immature, so how does that fit in?
It's funny how 40 doesn't seem as bad as when you were 20.
Yeah. No, not at all. I'm just an aging skeptic.
All right. The first news item. Couple of hicks down south think they have the body of Bigfoot. These guys in Georgia, just to cut to the chase on that one. These two guys.
So says overreactive Cryptomundo, Lauren Coleman. And
So Matthew Whitten and Rick Dyer.
Whitten.
Who run the BigfootTracker.com claim they have the body of Bigfoot.
Well, the first thing, when Bob and I were talking about this earlier, like, this is just the old standby, like, okay, where's the body? Okay, let's see the physical evidence. You know, why is it always secret? Why is it always hidden behind some closed door? And, you know, the information is going to be doled out. Like, why don't they just, like, take a video, have, you know, respected science be there, scientists be there, and just get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what's their game? What are they trying to do now?
Right.
It's a publicity stunt.
Well, they're going to announce at a press conference on Friday. This will be after we record, but before the show comes out. But right. You know, I'm willing to bet that there's not going to be anything too surprising at the press release.
What do you mean nothing too surprising? It's Bigfoot. They're going to show Bigfoot. And then there will be real scientists there, real biologists who are trusted and respected in their industry. And they're going to say, yes, we've examined the evidence. And it is definitely Bigfoot. And then there will be plenty of photos of, like, Bigfoot. Yeah. Autopsy, and there'll be fur samples, and, you know, Diane Fossey will be there. It'll be great.
Yeah, that's right.
Fecal samples.
Louis Leakey. And they always fail to deliver 100%. Have you ever heard of this guy, Tom Biscardi? He's the CEO of a company called Searching for Bigfoot Incorporated.
Oh.
And he has
a big moneymaker.
It's great.
He has a hand in on this August 15th presentation that's supposedly going to be happening. And this guy apparently has quite a history of making all sorts of claims, coming up with all sorts of Bigfoot bodies, parts, and other quote-unquote evidence, but never, ever once delivers anything. Mm-hmm. He just talks a big game. And he's even shunned, and he's disregarded by other Bigfoot societies out there. So there's kind of this war going on, in a sense, between these Bigfoot groups. And this fellow, Tom Biscardi, is, well, there's not a lot of love for him out there, let's just say that.
Yeah, but Evan, I mean, he shot his wad on this one. Like, he's making the big claim this time. Like, there's no recovering from this.
Well, this is kind of all or nothing, you know, I guess, if you're a Bigfoot proponent. So, Evan, are you saying that this guy is like the hoaxer who's shunned by the true believers? Yeah, is that...
Yeah, exactly. That's right. They're saying that this guy's take on and claims about Bigfoot are all wrong. However, you know, our Bigfoot group is perfectly fine.
Oh, well, yeah. And the people who are saying that are BFRO, right? The Bigfoot Research Organization or whatever.
That's right.
Those are the dumbasses who got sucked in by Penn and Teller's Bigfoot scam last year. So they came out breathlessly declaring that video the next, like, real evidence of Bigfoot. And they were totally suckered. So I guess on the one hand, it's nice to see them being skeptical for once, but on the other hand, it's like, come on, guys.
They're being skeptical, but not for the right reasons. They're being skeptical because they because of either, you know, jealousy or some sort of professional
competition
going on, and you know they don't want this guy, you know, grabbing any kind of glory.
Well, you know, I'm just saying any kind of skeptical is better than no skeptical at all.
I agree with that. I agree with that.
Yeah, but the vast majority of the Bigfoot fans out there, I mean, they're not sitting around, in my opinion, intelligently like, oh, this, you know, this happens to be a very low resolution picture of, you know, this new claim. I mean, they're like, you know, these are guys, Bigfoot, you know, those guys. Like, they're all, like, completely excited. They're all, can't wait till Friday. They think everything is going to be, like, they actually believe it again and again and again that there is going to be some real physical evidence that's going to prove it.
I hope somebody clips that bit of you going, guys, Bigfoot, and plays it at random.
You know, but the thing is, the picture is low res. You know, I'm looking on the web, like, it's always some low res, weird angle picture. Nothing ever seems that clear. This is just so already out of the gate. This is just another typical.
Right. This is funny though, because somebody on some website is claiming that this is all a hoax and trying and giving a lot of background. Evan, I think you sent us that link. What was really funny to me was that they said they had a link saying that the picture that they used to say that, hey, this is the face of the Bigfoot corpse. They said that this is a costume. It's a costume. So I clicked the link, and it brought me to a Halloween costume site that I frequent quite often, looking for Halloween props. And it linked to a really high end Sasquatch costume, like a costume that, you know, cost $600 or $700, really nice one that supposedly these hoaxers used as for the corpse. I don't know if they stuffed it with stuff or how they're doing it.
Did it look the same, Bob? Did it look like it was it?
Similar.
Close enough.
Even Lauren Coleman, in his breathless wrap-up on Cryptomundo, at the very end, he's like, some people are saying it looks like a costume. And he puts a picture of dead Bigfoot next to a picture of a costume and then overlaps them. And they look exactly the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's just like the last little chunk of his long post about how exciting this is, how can't wait for Friday, and it's like, what is wrong with you? You're a child.
Did you guys see the YouTube video that these two guys put out?
No,
Witten and Dyer.
I didn't watch.
I read about it.
I
read about it. It was like a joke. It was.
It's funny, you know. So these guys, they're just pimping, you know, BigfootTracker.com and say we're the best Bigfoot trackers in the world because we have the body. So this is their story. They tracked the Bigfoot. They actually think they tracked it, and they found a community of Bigfoot, and they found community. The dead body. They didn't kill it. They found it dead, and they brought it back. But they saw multiple individuals. That's what they claim. Now they don't have any video or pictures or physical evidence of the multiple living Sasquatch.
They wouldn't bring cameras with them. You know, of course not.
Well, they're just not. If they did, they're not showing it. They're playing their cards close to the vest, as it were. They have the dead Bigfoot that they found in a freezer. They did call in a scientist, some young guy whose name I didn't recognize, to take DNA samples, and they're supposed to present the results of that on Friday. And they will not disclose the location from where they got the Bigfoot. So again, this has all the red flags of a hoax, as Jay was saying. The details are always sketchy. There's never independent confirmation, not the kind of scientific sort of circus that you would expect, you know, if this were a genuine find. It's a couple of guys, you know, who have this elaborate story and just the tantalizing bits of evidence. And I suspect on Friday what we're going to get is just more ambiguous stuff. It's not verifiable. You know, the body should be laid out on a table with any scientist, you know, who wants to, should be able to take a look at it, test samples, CT it. They should be able to, you know, do a real scientific dissection. And until that kind of stuff happens, it's just another ambiguous story.
Bring in Jeff Corwin. He'll identify it.
Why a DNA I don't understand. What? Are they going to compare that DNA, quote-unquote, to something else? I mean, what?
That DNA test is reasonable. What you'd want to do, if it is a Bigfoot, then you would suspect that it would be some unknown primate, and not only
a
primate.
Yeah, something that's not human, not a known gorilla.
Yeah, but something like in that.
The
hominoid, you know, family. So yeah, something
like
that's close.
Gigantopithecus.
Something, yeah. That's what you would expect. That's what you would predict. If it matches exactly to an extant animal, then...
Or say a costume shop.
At, or it's, you know. Yeah, or it's... Plastic
mall.
Fibers, you know, or something.
Well, that's just it. I mean, no costume has DNA, so.
Right. Well, but, you know, who knows? There could be levels of trickery in there. Who knows? They could have somehow mixed together parts of different primates in there to maybe trick somebody, the scientist, into
Piltdown
hoping they'd
man
get
man.
Contaminated. Yeah, like a Piltdown Man thing where they took the... The skull of a human and the jaw of an orangutan. I don't know, so there could be that kind of hoax going on.
They don't strike me as that elaborate or you know.
Oh, I wouldn't right. put it, but, things too far beyond them. I mean, clearly they've put a lot of time and energy and money into this.
Yeah.
If it's a hoax, they're destroying any credibility that they have. No?
Of course.
You mean none?
Of course.
Yeah. Well, so, I just think it's funny
risk
they
nothing,
have credibility.
The game
I mean, so that's like it's an end game for them. Then you know what I
mean?
No, like
well, think about it this way, Jay. Though, think about what's happened in the past. They'll make their claims. They'll put out their ambiguous evidence. It'll be debunked. They'll claim there's a conspiracy to silence them. They'll become underground celebrities of the Bigfoot world, but it will not gain acceptance in the scientific
community.
Could
there possibly be a more dubious distinction than underground celebrity of the Bigfoot world?
But that's the career
that's
cycle
like,
for these people.
It's not even I'm big in Japan. Oh yeah, well I'm big on the underground circuit. Amongst Bigfoot enthusiasts.
Well, it's like
look, Jay,
UFO
like
people.
Guys.
Yeah, it's like UFO experts, you know, we're celebrities within the UFO community, but have no cred outside of that. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on. The next story is about the headlines read The Invisible Man, or finally, Science Discovers the Invisible Man.
And my favorite title of article of all the articles I came across was Muggles, a step closer to creating invisibility cloak.
Oh, God.
That was awesome. But let me give you some background. In 67, Soviet physicist Viktor Veselago put forth the hypothesis that a material could have a negative refractive index without breaking any apparent laws of physics. It took many years for anyone to really to do any tests on his ideas. It's at its most basic level, refraction is a change of direction due to a change in speed. Like when light... We've all seen it when you put a straw in the water, the light going from the air with one refractive index to the water with another bends it. It changes the speed of the light, which then changes the direction that it's going in. And that could also happen not only with light, but it could happen with sound and pretty much any type of wave. But now, if water had a negative index like these materials that we're talking about, these metamaterials, the straw would seem to point out of the water. Or if you were looking at a pond with a fish in it and the water had a negative refractive index, the fish would seem to be floating above the water. So it's a very interesting phenomena. Veselago's ideas were untested until the turn of the millennium, about 8 years ago, when a metamaterial was created at Imperial College in London using copper rings and wires layered onto like circuit board materials and stuff. And they proved in 2001 that microwaves were actually exhibited a negative refractive index, or that negative refraction was taking place.
And they cook burritos.
Ah, there you go. Now, metamaterials, I always thought that was such a cool-sounding word, but it's actually got a specific meaning, but it's used differently by different people. Maybe it's not very specific. But basically, it's an engineered product that interacts with electromagnetic waves in ways that materials found in nature do not. So it's like it's definitely not a natural substance. They're typically made from things like metals and ceramics, Teflon, fiber composites, etc. Now, the big hubbub, though, the reason why this is in the news again, I mean, it seems like it's been in the news over and over and over, but there were some severe limitations to these metamaterials in the past, like they could only work in the microwave range. So they, you know, people don't see in the microwave, so people can never be used for any sort of invisibility device. It worked with two-dimensional materials, like a single layer of atoms, and that a lot of the light was absorbed. So these were all problems. So this is what they've got around most recently. But it's not one metamaterial that they created. It's two different metamaterials that each tackle some of these problems. One of them is the first three-dimensional material that has a negative index of refraction. So that's like really the biggest breakthrough. It's the first three-dimensional material. This other metamaterial doesn't have much negative refraction. It's got a little bit of it, but it does it with visible light. So those two together, they made it seem like it's this new metamaterial, but it's actually two different types. But that doesn't mean that they can't somehow, you know, combine them in the future as well.
So is this the reporting on this, like every fossil's a missing link? Now every little breakthrough in this area is we have an invisibility cloak.
Well, the invisibility cloak, everyone stresses that because it's such a knee-jerk, visceral reaction to invisibility. You know, how cool is invisibility? And that's one of the things that upsets me about it, because they focus on this, the Harry Potter stuff and invisibility. And, you know, there is some beef in that hamburger. I mean, I think they could potentially scale this up and offer some sort of impressive invisibility. But a cloak like Harry Potter, I think that might be completely unworkable. I mean, think about it. You got a moving, flowing cloak maintaining stealth, and that would be many orders of magnitude more difficult than just creating an invisible sort of box type of thing. And there's also the fact that, as of now at least, these metamaterials are hundreds of times bigger than you would be. So if it's not like something you could actually put on. It'd be like a house you'd be in or something like that. Mm-hmm. But now the big guy behind this thing is Xian Zhang, professor of University of California, Berkeley. This guy is heading the research team that's writing these papers, and this is like the main guy in this stuff. And he says that, of course, cloaking captures everyone's attention, but these papers aren't just about cloaking. And that's true, because these things have so many potential applications. It kind of reminded me of nanotubes, in a sense, that there's so many diverse applications that this can be applied to. But you don't read too much about it. It's always about, you know, this invisibility cloak stuff. Like, for example, super lenses. There's the potential to make a super lens which can actually resolve beyond the so-called diffraction limit of normal lenses, letting them focus things like you know, little things like molecules or proteins inside cells. Amazing stuff. There's people are talking about being able to boost the internet capacity or speed tenfold using metamaterials and
like for fiber optics.
And right, because you're basically manipulating light, and it's not just bandwidth within fiber optics. It actually can speed up the internet by slowing it down, because a lot of times you've got a lot of these optical signals coming in all at once, and they're difficult to handle. But if you could actually slow them down and shunt them in the proper way, you could actually increase efficiencies and things like that. So, and that's just another way. I mean, they theorize you could use this for quantum computing. You could boost the power of microchips and antennas and photolithography. Think about it. If you can focus light down to less than half a wavelength, then you wouldn't need to find shorter wavelength, higher intensity light. You could use the same wavelengths you're using now, but just focus them down beyond that diffraction limit. So there's lots of other applications. That's my big beef, is that it's all about the stupid invisibility stuff, and you kind of...
So really what we're talking about is developing materials that can manipulate light in new and interesting ways. And
then
remains to be seen how, you know, that they could be exploited or implemented in specific technologies. But again, yeah, the invisibility thing is just the sexy headline, but doesn't necessarily have anything to do with this, and in fact may never actually be an application of these materials.
Especially not in the terms they're talking about, like a cloak that you could wear. But it does look good for something bigger, like, say, hiding bigger objects or masking your heat signature, which would be very valuable for...
Yeah, I'll believe it when I don't see it.
Yeah. You've been waiting to say that. You've been waiting.
It just popped into my head. That sounds cool, Bob. But I'm shocked that the mainstream media got the story all wrong. How does that happen?
I don't think it's ever happened before. I think it's first, actually.
It's got to happen once in a while.
Let's give them a break.
The next news item has to do with Prince Charles, who was interviewed recently and went on one of his quote-unquote rants about genetically modified crops.
Is he an expert?
Steve, we've talked about this before. I think I remember you being quite disturbed by his lack of real information.
Yeah, well, I know we've talked about the fact that, the prince is into homeopathy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, he's ignorant in a wide variety.
Yeah, he's not just doesn't restrict his ignorance to just one topic.
Must be all that genetic modification of his bloodline.
Yeah. apparently the prince likes all things natural, so he likes to partake of the naturalistic fallacy and thinks that things that are unnatural are evil and going to destroy the world. You know, he said a lot of real howlers in this interview where he went on his rant. He said, for example, relying on gigantic corporations for food would be an absolute disaster. He said, why else are we facing all these challenges, climate change and everything?
Yeah, what logical fallacy is that?
Well, that's just a non sequitur. I mean, you know, just linking two things that are not necessarily linked.
I was thinking, is that a confusing association with causation?
It could be, but, you know, the correlation is so vague. You know, bad stuff's happening, so it's, I'm going to blame it on this, you know. he accused big companies of, quote-unquote, a gigantic experiment, I think, with nature and the whole of humanity, which has gone seriously wrong. Yeah, I've read a lot of analysis of what of this interview and the things that he said, and of course this is has to do with the bigger issue of genetically modified food. So first, just talking about the Prince Charles interview, most of it was just the evils of genetic modification. That's an experiment on humanity and on food. Really, just ideologically negative against GM food. He's very pro organic farming and pro. Natural foods and against anything corporate or artificial. But the one thing he did say that has a kernel of truth to it that some of the commenters picked up on was he said that increasing food production will not solve the problem of food security. And what he means by that is food security is just assuring that everyone has access to adequate food, that no one's going hungry. And that is true, although it's a non sequitur in the context of the GM food debate, because if you guys remember over the past year, there's been the rising price of food worldwide, and a lot of people are not getting access to food, and in fact, it's not due to a shortage of food; it's just due to a shortage of
An inability to get those people.
That's it's just an inability to get the food to those people, the inability of those people to afford the food. But it's not a shortage of food; we're making enough food to feed the world. It's just not getting it to everybody who needs it. But I think that may be true that food production doesn't necessarily solve the problem of food access or food security. But that doesn't mean that the two are not related. Certainly, if we had inadequate food production, that would assure that we didn't have adequate, food security. So adequate food production is a prerequisite, but it's not sufficient to ensure food security. And GM food absolutely increases our food yields. There's no question about that. So the quick overview on genetically modified food is that this is using technology to take genetic material, genes, from one species and put it into another, mainly crop plants. This has been going on actually for decades, although not really to a large degree until the last 10 or 20 years or so. Right now, most people out there, you have eaten genetically modified food. About 50 to 60% of the food that finds its way into processed foods has been genetically modified or contains genetically modified food. Most of the raw food streams are mixed downstream, so at the manufacturing level. This is actually something that's been going on for 15,000 years in a way. None of the food that we eat, I say virtually none, I'm not sure it's absolutely none, but virtually none of the food that we eat looks anything like it did as it naturally evolved or occurred in nature.
Yeah, before man, selectively bred it or grafted one thing to another and all that. Yeah.
We've talked about the banana before.
Right.
Being a perfect example.
Everything, corn, banana, wheat, pretty much all the vegetables and all the fruits and everything. It's been cultivated over thousands of years by various populations. You're using various techniques. So selection, cultivation and selection, growing the ones that have the best fruit and then selecting the best from that. But also crossbreeding and making hybrids.
It's a hybrid.
Which is, hybrid is mixing genes from one species to another species. And in plants, although, it has to be a reasonably or a fairly closely related species, in plants, cross-pollination or this hybridization can occur a lot farther, you know, evolutionarily farther away from one species than, say, it can among mammals, where, I mean, among animals, where animals can typically only, you know, have fertile offspring with very closely related other populations or species. And plants, they can go a lot farther afield, as it were, and still hybrid.
It's a damn good thing that humanity has done this over thousands of years. I mean,
oh yeah,
you know, the properties of some of our favorite fruits and vegetables, for example, you know, the reason why those things taste as good as they do and that they're packaged the way that they're packaged, I mean, you know, just the way that they're grown, like with the thickness of an apple being one way or the flavor of an orange, like all of those things were selectively bred over a very long period of time. I mean, and I find it curious to think about how, you know, you always just think those plants are out there, or were out there. Somebody stumbled across an orange tree one day and ate an orange and was like, oh my God, this is fantastic. But it wasn't that. Like, one of my favorite examples is that the modern carrot was grown from a weed called Queen Anne's lace.
Yeah, if you pull up a Queen Anne's lace and you smell the root, it smells like a carrot.
Yeah.
That's right. And though our civilization couldn't exist without the very high quality food that we've cultivated. And it's not just plants too, it's also animals. You know, we're bred to be not only domesticated, but
I have one on my lap right now.
So, but you know, cultivation and cross pollination is not a perfect analogy to genetic modification. It just the reason for that example is to destroy the naturalistic fallacy where things are as they occurred in nature, were healthier for us or better for us. Now, we've already transformed what occurred naturally beyond all recognition to suit our needs and our civilization. That's already happened. What genetic modification does, though, it takes a specific gene or cluster of genes from one species and puts them in another and in a way that could not have happened through hybridization or cross-pollination. So you could take a gene from a bacteria and put it into a corn plant. That's something that just would not happen without, you know, this sort of direct technological intervention.
And the thing is, that is something we need to be really careful about, and we do need to have controls in place to make sure that you know, we don't F up and spread something around the world that we don't want out there, some invasive species that we make up in a lab. But the problem is that the opponents of these things take it way too far, just like the opponents of big pharma or things like that, where you start out with a legitimate criticism and then just go off the cliff, and it kind of ruins the whole original point too.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So this is it. This is one of those emotionally charged topics where there's actually a lot at stake for humanity on both sides. There's a lot to be gained. There's a lot to be risked. And if you just take a firm ideological view one way or the other, you're not going to be making rational decisions as an individual, a country, our civilization. I think that this is one of those areas where, you know, we need to have a well-informed debate, that we have to get the science right. And what happens is what you say, Rebecca, is that people have an ideological stance and then they cherry pick and distort the science to fit their ideology, rather than saying, let's at least all agree on the science, on the facts. And then if we have disagreements about the proper balance of risks versus benefit, or if there are value judgments that are different or political differences, let's talk. That's okay. It's okay to have political differences. But, you know, at least the discussion should be well informed by good science. And I just, the whole debate gets so distorted when people work backwards from their ideology and then try to distort the science. That's what's destroying this. And that comes up with things like recycling, with organic farming, with global warming. Those are all topics where it's really hard to get the facts straight because everyone who's reporting on the facts is putting their heavy spin on it. And I even find it difficult, you know, to sort through all the spin and cherry picking to find out what's really going on.
And Steve, here we have another celebrity, you know, much like we've talked about Jenny McCarthy and autism and all that. This is the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, think about this. Prince Charles accused genetic engineers of taking us, quote, into realms that belong to God and God alone.
Mm-hmm. right.
when criticizing the scientists about genetic modification of foods. I mean, yep. You know, he's
about
just
being blind,
lending his celebrity for this kind of nonsense.
Yeah,
I mean,
and
frankly, I don't know how many people pay attention.
But
to
Evan,
Charles
he doesn't. You know, he really does
things,
believe
but,
it, though. I mean, I've read a lot.
I'm sure he does.
Of things
I'm
about,
sure he does
about his comments.
It.
But the point is, who cares what he thinks about it? He's not a scientist. What is he? You know, why should we care what he thinks about this?
He's an English nobleman, sir.
But so here, just to run down the list. Here are the potential benefits of genetically modified food. And these are benefits that have been realized. These are not theoretical. Genetic modification has been used to increase the yield of staple food crops like wheat and rice and corn and barley and those kind of things. And not just like a 5 or 10% increase, but multiple times, 5-10 times the yield. Again, could not feed the world if we didn't have genetically modified crops to farm. We have genetically modified crops to be resistant to disease, which again makes them actually safer to eat because there's less of a chance that they'll be contaminated with fungus and other things like that, and also reduces the need for pesticides and fungicides and whatnot. So it's reducing actually the introduction of these chemicals into the environment. Also, by increasing efficiency, either cows that make more milk or whatever, that actually reduces the footprint of, you know, industrial farming and husbandry on the environment. We have to cut down less forests for farming if we can grow more food on a certain patch of land. Or, you know, we have less global warming methane from cow farts if we can get more milk from fewer cows. So increased food production efficiency actually has a lot of downstream benefits on the environment as well.
Steve, let me throw one more advantage here. The pharmaceutical link, you could actually use GM to create edible vaccines in tomatoes and potatoes and other foods that they're easier to ship, store, and administer to the areas of the world that just don't have the money or the resources to get conventional, you know, injections to their people. I mean, that's just another possible.
Not possible, absolutely, benefit. But absolute benefit. I was just talking about food, but you're right. If you want to talk about pharmaceuticals, a lot of drugs that are already on the market are made with recombinant bacteria. So these are genetically modified bacteria. You put a gene in for the drug, and then we have vats of bacteria cranking out these complicated drugs. That has drastically reduced the manufacturing cost, and of course, made drugs available cheaper to more people. So, but even just without the vaccine or the pharmaceutical angle to it, just making food more nutritious, like making rice that has more vitamin A in it, and curing hundreds of millions of children from blindness, or preventing hundreds of millions of cases of blindness. You know, modifying food in this way to increase yield, make it more nutritious, make it more resistant, has saved more lives and increased the quality of life for more people than probably any other thing, any other piece of technology that we've come up with. It really is dramatic. So here's the downside. Here's what I see as one definite downside, is that genetically modified food encourages the use of the most optimal food type. So, for example, if we come up with a GM tomato, that's the perfect tomato. You know, it has the best yield, the best flavor, it's resistant to disease. Everyone's going to plant that food, that tomato, because that you get the more bang for your buck. But what that does is that it dramatically reduces genetic diversity. And that makes the whole crop vulnerable to blight.
But you can control for that, though. You can make different kinds of tomatoes and prevent that from happening.
Absolutely. I completely agree. That was the next thing I was going to say, is that is not an insurmountable problem. What that means is that we need to go out of our way to not only preserve local varieties, preserve genetic diversity. And that may mean that even though it may not be the most cost-effective in the short term, we may need to produce 100 or 200 varieties of tomatoes that have the advantages that we're going for, but that are still different enough that preserve some of the genetic diversity, that we're not going to be putting all of our eggs in one basket. But here's the real hysteria ones, the ones that are mainly theoretical. In other words, they haven't actually, the worst nightmares have not ever been realized. These are just things that are warned about. And this is, it has, for example, scared a lot of the European population, just the public, away from genetically modified food. So one fear is that, as Rebecca said, we're going to introduce some gene into the ecosystem in a way that could not have occurred through just natural, you know, cross-pollination or breeding, and then we may, you know, unleash some freakish, unnatural monster as an invasive species into the ecosystem.
And when you say unnatural monster, see, the thing is that a lot of groups will expand that to actually literally mean like a fish that, you know, walks on seven legs and, you know, you know, zaps you with its eyes. But, you know, what a lot of people don't understand is that right now we have a problem with invasive species just through regular old cross-pollination and from transferring plants from country to country, from continent to continent. Blueberries, for instance, I think are a common one. And they are, to the natural world, monsters, where they will take over an area and destroy the local wildlife.
Yeah, no, invasive species are a huge problem, but you're right. They have nothing to do with genetically modified, you know, organisms, and there's a much bigger problem just from shipping around the world. So, yes, what that means is that we need to be careful, you know, about what genes we put into what species, and we need to do a proper amount of safety testing and research. So I think, again, that's a reasonable concern that can be addressed through evidence and research and proper regulation and doesn't require, you know, hysterical reaction. Another concern that is sometimes raised is that this may introduce proteins into foods that can cause allergic reactions. Again, just because they're not proteins that humans are used to being exposed to. I have two comments about that. One is that we're actually, ironically, using genetic modification to make known allergens or foods that are known to cause allergies less allergenic, like peanuts, right? So they're actually genetically modifying a peanut that does not cause a peanut allergy. So that's a very real benefit. The theoretical benefit of causing allergens, we have really no reason to suspect that GM crops will be more allergenic. This is purely a speculative concern. And again, that could be dealt with through testing. And of course, you know, like any drug that we introduce into the population or any new food or anything new, you test it on a certain number of people to ensure that it's relatively safe. And then, you know, just there's no way around the fact that you won't know what its full safety profile is until it's in broader use. So anyway, so this is a debate that's, you know, not going away. But I think like the other topics that we mentioned, nothing against the political, the ideological discussion, just the science should be accurate and should inform the politics, not the other way around.
Plus, this whole debate is a stopgap anyway until the time we construct our food using tabletop nanofactories.
Right, of course, there is always that.
Can you pass the nano salt, please?
One more quick news item. This one's a lighthearted item. This is the crazy rainbow lady. Have you guys seen this video?
Crazy.
Yes.
It's awesome.
Home.
It's awesome. We've gotten it about a million times from our listeners. It's very funny. This is, you know, I guess anybody could put a video up on YouTube these days. This woman put up a video because she needed to inform the world, because she, I guess she figured she was the only one to realize this, that the government is tainting our water, putting chemicals or whatever kind of horrible things into our water. And she knows this is happening, metals, shiny stuff. She knows this is happening because she could see a rainbow in her sprinkler.
And 20 years ago, you couldn't see rainbows in sprinklers.
Right. We didn't have no rainbows.
Show me a YouTube video from 20 years ago, and you know.
Not then, rainbows. No, didn't have one when I was a kid.
You know, I actually, it's one of those experiences where you're watching this video, and I have to think to myself, is she for real? Is this just the funniest spoof I've seen in a long time, or is she for real? It's hard. It's hard to say because this is the kind of thing you couldn't satirize. You know,
I think it's real. She just, you can't fake that sincerity.
I don't know. I think my gut is it's probably real. I agree with Bob. I think that this woman is sincere. And usually when people do try to satirize this kind of thing, they throw in a little tell. You know, deliberately. You know, they'll say something that's a little bit over the top, just to give
us a clue
us in that this is a spoof.
A little.
It'll get more crazy as it goes on. This one seems sincere.
Although really, like, usually people that crazy don't understand how to use the internet.
Yeah, so someone was helping her, I guess.
Know, yeah, someone helped her. Yeah,
editing a video, that's pretty advanced for crazies of her level.
But, you know, if we have to say it, this is kooky because this is just the refraction of light through the droplets of water. Droplets of water form little spheres, which then acts as little prisms, which separates the light. And that's why you see natural rainbows, right? So I wonder why this woman thinks rainbows occur in the sky from rain. If she thinks that this is the rainbows only occur from the sprinkler now because of stuff the government's putting in the water. Or maybe she just didn't make that connection between this rainbow in her sprinkler and the rainbow in the sky.
You know, I can't really spend any more time getting inside that woman's head because
there's not enough room in there.
It was a total lawn chair, you know, diatribe on something she knows absolutely nothing about, not even an inkling about what she's talking about. And
she
that's
was able
why
to turn the sprinkler on. That's something.
Yeah, but I just, you know, I always set the stage in my head. Okay, this woman goes outside, you know, has got her gin and tonic at 1:30 in the afternoon. And she turns on her sprinkler and she sees the rainbow. And instead of being like interested or, you know, like the negativity in her is so intense, it blew my mind. It actually made me kind of like, ew, like she really seems disgusting to me.
The other thing I think about with these kind of videos is this person mentally ill?
Yeah.
And I didn't get that vibe. Because if they were, I wouldn't want to talk about it. Because seriously, I don't answer emails from people that I think honestly are diagnosable, and I wouldn't want to.
Is that why you've never responded to any of my emails?
Oh, she's on to me. But seriously, like, I don't get that vibe off this woman. She's very coherent in the way she speaks and doesn't have any of that affectation that I've come to recognize in patients who have a psychotic disorder. So I think that she's just, as Jay said, just sort of an armchair philosopher who doesn't have the common sense to, like, ask a couple of questions. And I guess nobody in her life who said, hey, you know, mom or auntie or whoever, this is a rainbow like the rainbow you get in the sky. You know, this is not a government conspiracy. Oh, well. It is like a freak show. It's like the car accident on the side of the road. You have to slow down and see how bad it is, you know.
Government. Yeah.
Well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Alan Malikjanian, otherwise known as Captain Disillusion. Alan, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you very much. How are you?
We're all great, thanks. So, Alan, you've been doing for a few months now, right? You have, I believe, 11 episodes that I've seen on YouTube of these short videos called Captain Disillusion. Tell us about those.
Well, I basically do, it's a web series and kind of a fancy vlog, I guess, that's tackles all kinds of paranormal and weird, unexplainable videos that are floating around YouTube, and I kind of try to do it in a humorous way through this fictional character called Captain Disillusion, where I kind of break the technicalities of how the videos are done. You know, sometimes it might be like a paranormal video that people are claiming is real, and sometimes it's just something really, you know, tricky that people want to know how it's done. So I just break it down for them when I know how it is done.
It seems like you know how everything is done. That's what amazes me, is that, you know, I watch your videos. You've got them all pinpointed. Where do you get that knowledge?
I think that's an illusion in itself. I just kind of pick my battles, and if I know how it's done, then, or at least I can sort of extrapolate it reasonably, I go for it. But if I don't know, I don't mess with it. At least I study it in detail before I go for it. But I mean, I come from a background of really just filmmaking and visual effects and animation. So that's sort of the area that you could see for most of the videos that I stick to when I see that it was something to do with visual effects or some kind of an attempt on somebody's part to, you know, mess with a video in post-production. That's what I try to break down. I stay away from more broad topics, you know, sort of skepticism in general. But I think I might kind of expand into that as time goes on. Because I'm new, I guess. I'm new at this.
How long exactly have you been doing this?
Well, I don't know. I got to look back whenever the first video came out. But the original, the first video, I think, is the penguin slapping one. Mm-hmm. And it started out as, it wasn't a video at first. I just wrote this, like, really sarcastic blog entry on MySpace just because I saw that video and figured out how it was done. And I just wanted some kind of, like, a you know, a framework of how to present it, some kind of cocky kind of thing. That's what I did. And then later on, I was looking for something to do as a video, and I just saw that it was sort of a ready-made script already, and went for it. I don't know. Like, the response was really surprising to me. So I just, but it wasn't really until I made a couple more, because I don't know, I didn't have any other ideas, so I just kept doing this thing, and I just really saw a response. And in a way, I kind of discovered the whole skeptics movement from that, because I didn't follow any of this before.
Yeah, so you didn't come into this as like a skeptical activist and just try to finding your niche. You just did this because it's something you're interested in, and then only discovered skepticism secondly.
Yeah, parallel, I guess. I come from a from the Soviet Union and from a circus family, like of circus performers. So I always kind of wanted to be an entertainer. I think the first thing I ever wanted to be was like a magician as a kid. And so, you know, I kind of naturally follow what magicians are doing. I, of course, kind of followed Penn and Teller when I got to this country, and obviously discovered their show, Bullshit, and kind of saw some of that parallel at the same time as I was kind of messing around with this, with the Captain Disillusion idea. So it was kind of that was probably my entry into the whole world of skepticism. And through them, I saw the work of Randy. And actually, you know, I started sort of researching all this, and you know, I didn't really know that there was even a movement. It was kind of refreshing to find that. Later on, when there were already a few episodes of Captain Disillusion out, I actually got an email from someone at JREF, and then later a call from Randy himself, who saw the videos, and he was like really impressed with them. At least that's what he told me. I don't know. Maybe he's just being nice. Yeah, so I got to meet, and I discovered that JREF is actually like 20 minutes from where I live in South Florida. That was very, very like, sort of a weird chain of events. So I met Randy and kind of got into this whole thing, and it's really exciting.
And I also want to point out that you actually were sneaky, and you were in Las Vegas during TAM. You were at TAM, and you had hundreds of fans there, I bet, and nobody knew it was you.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't know whether that was the case, because I discovered that literally nobody ever recognizes me without the, you know, the Captain Disillusion getup, apparently, at all. I didn't think it was that much of a disguise, but I did, like, whenever, and then I was, like, being all modest about it. It's not like I went around, you know, introducing myself, oh, I'm Captain Disillusion. I just kind of got to know a few people, and when the subject came to Captain Disillusion, and I kind of mentioned, oh, yeah, that's me, I do that, almost everyone was always like, oh, that's you? Then, you know, they've all seen it, so.
We've had tremendous feedback. People love your videos, and I think that what you're doing is, you're using YouTube more effectively than I think just about anybody else out there who's doing anything skeptical. And you're reaching a really broad audience. Do you have any idea of how many viewers you have in total?
Well, I think it's coming up on like 5,000 subscribers right now, and the views are really high. It's kind of growing, and I think it's just a matter of me doing a little more of them, you know, a little more frequently. Because they don't come out that often.
Yeah.
That's what I plan to do. I plan to definitely kind of bump up the volume, pump up the volume on the whole thing. And there's a lot. There's definitely no shortage of videos, which is something I was worried about at first. Because I did like two or three, and then I was thinking, well, this is kind of working, and maybe this is something I should continue doing. And I started looking around. I wasn't really finding, you know, anything else to base it on, like topical videos. But then with time, now every day people basically are sending me, you know, things they want to see me tackle. So it's like there's an endless supply of these ridiculous videos out there.
Alan, do you have a favorite one?
I don't know. I guess the way I look at them, I look at them very critically. So when the earlier they are, the older they are, the less I like them, because I was still kind of figuring out what I was doing. But I like the Haiti UFO one, because you get a little bit, you know, humor in there, and kind of it's like a broader overview of the subject. Like there's more you can talk about the video, about the details of the video, than something, you know, one dimensional like the penguin one. With the audience, the glasses, the catching glasses with face one seems to be the most popular.
Yeah.
Probably because it's more sort of, it's like a tutorial, you know, explaining how this is how this works, this is how that works. I think people dig that. They want to learn stuff, even if it's not, even if it's not stuff that's particularly useful to them in everyday life, they just kind of, like to know how things work.
Everyone wants to be in on the gag. They want to know how things work behind the scenes. They don't want to be taken.
It's not my intention, definitely, to like be sort of revealing tricks or anything like that. You know, that's not what that's about. I definitely take care to go, like, if I do something like that, like the glasses thing, I make sure that this is not something like an ongoing campaign or something that's, you know, somebody's trying to do some legitimate entertainment and I'm like kind of trying to undermine it. You know, I'm not going to reveal some magician's tricks. You know, people are always writing, you know, how to, you know, do Chris Angel or whatever. But that's not what Cabin Disillusion is about. Definitely. It's sort of clearing up misconceptions more than anything.
I think that's a great tactic to take because you're not that cynical, kind of bitter skeptic who's just debunking things. You seem to really have a genuine enjoyment of what you're doing. I think that comes through in your videos.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's kind of a key element, and I didn't really, it wasn't like a grand, you know, design that I figured out in advance, but I definitely see that humor is very important in it. I pretend that it's like a, you know, a show for kids, which it's not really, but that definitely helps to give it that air of lightheartedness. And I think that's a good attitude when dealing with a lot of ridiculousness out there. You shouldn't be frustrated by it because if you know what you're talking about, you can show other people that they shouldn't be intimidated. You know, there's people out there that are seeing these like ghost videos and stuff on YouTube and they get scared. You know, they're sitting in their room watching it and they're afraid. And I think if I kind of, you know, approach everything with that attitude, it helps people feel like, you know, I can look at this constructively and kind of debunk it. And I shouldn't be worrying about stuff like that.
The show, it pretends to be for kids, but I was wondering how much you were trying to appeal to younger audience, or at least make it accessible and acceptable, you know, to a younger audience. Just, you know, as an experiment, I had my 9-year-old daughter watch all your videos with me, too, and she seemed to get them and enjoy them, and certainly understood what you were explaining.
Right. So I guess it's sort of, I'm trying to make it compatible with the majority of like audience. It's kind of like The Simpsons or something that works on a couple of levels.
Yeah,
you know, it's working, so I'm just going to keep doing it this way.
So Alan, what's the deal with the makeup?
Well, again, I don't calculate things and figure out what is this symbolic of and what is it. I think at first I was just looking for some weird look to do, to throw something together to film the first one. But yeah. I mean, I can kind of pretend and say, well, it's, you know, it's revealing the truth. There's like the fake side and the reality. But I think in one of the videos, I kind of hint at the fact that the silver part is the real one. And the top, the human part is the makeup, really. It's just like this hero that's trying to not freak people out. So he has like a human disguise to kind of, you know, ease you into things. Actually, this is like Captain Disillusion, the name itself. I remember when I did meet Randy, he was really nice and, you know, very gracious. And, you know, I mean, you talk to that guy and it's like, it's just entertaining beyond anything. So he did ask me one thing, which is, you know, why did I call it Captain Disillusion? Why not? Because the name kind of has a little bit of a negative feel to it. You know, why not Captain Reality or something like that? And I thought about it, and it's more because I think the reason I did that is because for people that come from cultures or families where they're not objective thinkers, maybe, and they have a lot of these preconceptions and beliefs that are getting in the way, when they get exposed, when and if they get exposed to like skeptics movement or anything like that, or critical thinking, I think it's kind of hard for a lot of people to give up that sort of blanket. You know, it's a little bit of a freaky moment when you start to realize, you know what, there's a lot of things in my head that I've been kind of holding on to that were making it easier for me, but I got to let that go. I got to let all these things go. And then it's a little bit of a disillusion, you know, moment. But after that, it's like stepping into a jacuzzi where you start to realize, you know what, I'd rather think about reality. I'd rather think about, you know, the parts of the world, the parts of existence that I understand, and then try to figure out the rest. So maybe Captain Disillusion is that little bridge, I hope.
Plus it makes a nice logo, that symmetry.
Yeah, that too. Exactly. That's really what it's about.
Alan, how long does it take you to do an average episode of Captain Disillusion?
I don't do them normally as a continuous production. I will write some of it, and then I'll film it another day, and then there'll be some breaks in between where I'll do the post-production. But I guess if you consolidate everything, it takes probably about a couple days, anywhere from a couple days to like maybe a better part of a week.
And you're doing all of this just in your own free time, I assume. Do you have, like, what's paying the rent?
Well, it's sort of a transitional period right now because I'm involved in with some of these people I mentioned, my partners and friends, in a project called openfilm.com, which is a website for indie filmmakers or anyone that likes to see quality, independent-produced stuff and web videos. Like, YouTube is great, you know. YouTube is definitely on top and for finding anything, any piece of video that you really need. But, you know, there's a lot of things from TV or home videos and things like that. And I think for filmmakers, which I am also a filmmaker, an independent filmmaker, it's kind of hard to be visible in a place like YouTube. So we're doing a site where we can offer sort of higher quality and a more, you know, a better company of videos for people that create a little bit of higher level stuff. So openfilm.com, you can, like, right now, Captain Disillusion episode, they come out on YouTube, on the YouTube channel, but they also simultaneously become available on Open Film, where they are in higher quality. So if you want to see, like, the details of things, or can't make out sometimes what I'm saying in the YouTube version, you can definitely go to Open Film and check that out.
Are the comments of higher quality as well?
The comments? Well, yeah. Right now, hopefully that will be the case. We're sort of starting it out, and we have a lot of content, but we're trying to populate the site. So I've been hearing good things because it's, you're like in the company of fellow content creators, so they're not going to be just saying nonsense. But even on YouTube, I have to say that the comments are overwhelmingly positive. Really, I mean, especially like in, you can see all the comments that appear on videos and on the channel, but I also get a lot of mail, just messages. And there, I basically never, maybe in all the time that I've had Captain Disillusion, the channel, I've had like one comment that was like negative and ridiculous, but everything else is always just nothing but encouragement and compliments and really mostly just, recommendations of what people want to see me tackle next.
So are you married?
No, not married. So, no, I can't find a half-silvered a lady out there.
Yeah, do any girls you date want you to wear the makeup?
Yeah, I haven't heard that, but yeah, it's probably as people. I keep my secret identity secret, I guess. But as it starts to get out, I wouldn't be surprised if they start doing that.
You haven't found your Lois Lane yet?
No, unfortunately. I just think. The skeptics movement needs more exposure. It has a lot of exposure, but it's not nearly enough. And I just think, I like to be involved in that. And I just look at it as if what I do contributes to it, I'm happy. You know, I'm not trying to sort of turn it into some kind of franchise that's, you know, going to get all commercial and whatever. I'm just trying to entertain people, you know. Yeah. And if they get educated a little bit in the process, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much how we feel. I mean, we've proven the fact that there's no money in this. So
that's not true. Well, you guys, you're doing the YouTube thing too, right? I saw a couple of those videos. That's great. I think what you should do is, I don't know if you always use Skype or anything like that to put the podcast together, but you should kind of hook up the webcams and just have this sort of split screen. There's normally five people, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Four guys now. So, yeah, like, you know, yeah. You just do the four-way split screen and then, like, Rebecca in the middle, like Brady Bunch kind of thing.
Would that make me Alice, I think?
We'd have to look down into the
yeah,
right.
Yeah,
the
Rebecca left. Would have to look up at us, and that would be kind of funny, actually.
And then, Alan, we'd need you to edit in some crazy special effects. So we'd have to do it in front of a green screen.
The square sort of floating around, and you guys have to remember the cues of where to look at any given moment.
Yeah, well, we're just dabbling at this point. We're just sort of retrofitting stuff that we've already recorded with some video illustration and some, like, almost a slide presentation of material.
It's a good
presented.
Idea.
But going forward,
idea.
Yeah, we were interested in doing more actual video, you know.
I have to say, like, when I watch something like that and you guys, you know, tackle a couple of things, there that you have such a scientific approach. I mean, I may know a couple things about effects, but I'm really just from the entertainment, you know, side. I don't know half the time if I know what I'm talking about, you know. So, but when I hear you guys, anything just on the podcast, you know, when you start discussing some news item that's like related to, you know, astronomy or something, I just kind of, I go, I don't know half of what they just said, but it sounded awesome. So,
right well, on, see, you know? We know what we're talking about almost 2/3 of the time. So that's,
yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we can do some kind of SGU Captain Disillusion YouTube crossover sometime.
Like, what is that called? Yeah, crossover episode.
Right.
Perhaps. Yeah.
Have your people call my people and
do lunch.
We'll do a walk on or something.
I think our people are talking to your people right now.
Yeah, I'm open to that for sure.
Well, Alan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Alan.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Yes.
Great.
Absolutely.
Here we go.
Do it. Mm-hmm. Hurry up.
Item number 1, a new study comparing the prescribing of drugs for erectile dysfunction over the internet to traditional physician consultation found that internet prescribing had greater safety. Item number 2, the U.S. Olympic swim team is benefiting from top-secret technology based upon studies of fluid mechanics. And item number 3, a recent climate study indicates that the Burmese python, already well-established as an invasive species in South Florida, is likely to spread over much of the southern United States.
Wow, we talked about all that stuff earlier. How did you know we would be discussing all those things tonight?
I just one of those things.
It's very, very prescient.
Or 2 of those things.
Bob, go first.
U.S. Olympic team benefiting from top secret technology based on studies of fluid mechanics. Yeah, that sounds right to me. I do know that they're really benefiting from some of the technology, like some of the suits that the swimmers are wearing, and how they have a better interaction with the water than skin, much more, you know, slippery in the water. And I could see some sort of military studies, say, with fluid dynamics with submarines coming into some of this technology to help our guys. So that kind of makes sense to me. Let's see. Drugs for erectile dysfunction over the internet. Internet prescribing had greater safety. Well, of course, our knee-jerk reaction to that is supposed to be bullshit. But so it makes me think maybe there's some weird thing going on here that might make it actually safe. I don't know. Let's see. Number 3, the Burmese python. It's already in South Florida. It's likely to spread over much of the southern United States. A climate study that the python won. I'm going to say that is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Don't rush into anything, Bob. Are you sure?
A new study comparing the prescribing of drugs for erectile dysfunction over the internet versus traditional physician consultation found the internet prescribing had greater safety, meaning the internet prescriptions were safer, like they were from a more reputable drug outlet.
I'll say that it's not the drugs themselves, it's the appropriateness and the manner of the prescribing. The prescribing is safer, not that you could, even if you assume that the actual physical drugs themselves are the same.
Well, I'm still confused, and I'm not busting on you, Steve. I just like, who's prescribing these drugs to these people over the internet?
Well, I'm not going to go into more, you know, more elaborate detail than that. It's just,
no, I understand.
You
I
get a
ask.
Prescription over the internet versus seeing a physician in person and getting a prescription.
Well, I think it's intuitive here to say that if you go to a doctor, you're going to probably get a more accurate prescription. So that one, I hope, is wrong. The second one, sure, the technology for the U.S. Olympic swimmers, they spend an enormous amount of money on these types of things, and I 100% believe that. And the third one, the recent climate study indicates that the Burmese python, already well established as an invasive species in South Florida, is likely to spread over much of the southern United States. You know, okay, that's possible. I'm going to say that the internet drug one is the fake.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, the Burmese python is obviously an invasive species, and I do know that it's doing well in Florida, so I can see how it could spread, just as we were talking earlier. Invasive species are they're nasty stuff. So I think that's true. I think that the U.S. Olympic swim team is probably benefiting from fluid mechanic studies. I'm not sure how top secret they are. That's my only wild card. But I do know that, you know, they're already benefiting from technology in the form of their special swimsuits or whatever. So, yeah, that's true, I'm sure. Prescribing of drugs for erectile dysfunction over the internet. I'm going to say no. That sounds like a whole lot of BS. I could get a prescription for erectile dysfunction drugs over the internet right now.
Well, it would make your nipples hard.
I guess so.
Or you could just eat watermelon.
So would an ice cube.
That's a homeopathic remedy, Rebecca.
All right, Evan.
Save us from this banter, please.
I will. I will. My dear skeptical friends, I must agree with Bob, and I'm going with him in the Burmese python. I believe that one is the fiction.
Okay, so we got a split. But you all agree that the U.S. Olympic swim team is benefiting from top-secret technology.
Of course they are.
Based upon studies of fluid mechanics. Yeah, actually, you guys all, you know, pretty easily accepted that one. I thought that one kind of sounded a little... might have sounded a little unusual.
Conspiracy theory.
But that is science. It is science.
Yeah.
Top secret technology to help U.S. swimmers trim times at Beijing Olympics.
So what was it?
Can you elaborate on the details of the top secret?
Yes, I can. And the first of all, the world records are fallen by the wayside at this Olympics. And our boy Phelps is kicking butt. But this is a fluid mechanics professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. Professor Timothy Wei is using experimental flow measurement techniques to help swimmers sharpen their stroke. So it's not the suits. He's actually figuring out ways to alter their swimming techniques so that they move more efficiently through the water.
That's awesome.
What do you mean it's not the suits? What's not the suits?
The technology is not in the suits.
Well, there is technology in this.
Oh, I know that, but that's not what I'm talking about.
But the study he's talking about.
This is to sharpen their strokes.
No, settle down, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
Bob, settle
down. This is actually coaching their movements.
Bob, put down the knife. Put it down. It's not worth it.
He just made it sound like the suits weren't doing anything.
No, of course.
Two different technologies here. Yeah. They're both contributing.
Of course. That's just not what we're talking about here.
Easy, big fella.
So anyway,
imagine like tomorrow Bob calls Steve up. You know, Steve, I'm very upset about this swimsuit issue.
They're using digital particle image velocimetry. So just to...
You mispronounced the word.
It's a tough one. Velocimetry?
Velocimetry, baby.
It's not Thucydides.
Say Velociraptor. It's much cooler.
Velociraptor, yeah. They're using Velociraptors. So state-of-the-art water flow diagnostic technologies. And then just looking at the way, you know, forces interact with the fluid, et cetera, and then they're just using this to fine-tune the strokes. And it sounds plausible, and it must be working because, again, the world records are just being shattered, you know, pretty much every swimming event.
Correlation is not equal causation. Okay,
it's
next.
True.
Wow.
All right. Well, so we are split.
I feel a high five coming.
You do? All right,
yeah,
so let's go to number one, a new study comparing the prescribing of drugs for erectile dysfunction over the internet to traditional physician consultation found that internet prescribing had greater safety, and that one is science.
Woo-hoo. Bullshit.
Bob, it is. I was surprised, too. But once you read the explanation, it makes a little bit of sense.
It's too obvious, guys. Come on.
Yeah.
It's the obvious one sometimes is the fiction. You know, I do try to mix it up. Okay, but here's the thing. That... this wasn't just responding to spam emails about Viagra, right? This was internet prescribing. And the way it worked is you have to actually like go through a little online tutorial and you're given specific information online.
Like what? This is a picture of a flaccid penis. This is an erect penis.
No, you have to... you know, there are certain educational materials that...
Yeah, like, do not insert pill in top of penis, put in mouth.
Right, exactly, that kind of thing. You know, instructing people on how to use it, what side effects to look out for, and also, you know, getting information from them as part of the process of getting the prescription online without ever actually talking to or physically seeing a physician, as opposed to going to a physician's office and getting the prescription. You know what? And the measure they used for safety was compliance with the patient education. They used a number of measures, but a lot of the measures that they used of safety had to do with compliance with this kind of safety criteria. So, in most of the measures, the online prescribing outperformed the physician prescribing. For example, 100% of the e-medicine clients received written manufacturer product information, and 75.2% received tailored electronic messages, compared to only 51.8% of patients seeing a physician, a traditional physician consultation. So part of this, I think, was skewed by the way they measured safety. You know, it was mainly informational. And yeah, you know, the internet is actually a good mechanism for dispensing information. The other thing that the internet has is that using a computer model, basically, over a person is that it's a lot easier to standardize. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of this in medicine, because there are certain sets of information or practices in medicine that need to be standardized. And when they are standardized, the outcomes statistically are much better. So rather than leaving it up to, you know, the quirkiness of an individual physician, if you go through a computer program, you know that 100% of the time exactly what's going to happen, right? I mean, the computer programs are just much more consistent and reliable.
Steve, do you think the doctor may come into play as well? Like, maybe the doctor is uncomfortable talking about it, or the patient's uncomfortable talking about it, and not enough information is passed?
Yeah, that's a good point, too. I mean, so it may be easier to interface with a computer about certain touchy topics. And, well, you know, I'd like to think that most physicians get comfortable talking about these kind of issues with patients. There is still – that does play a role. That does play a role. Some physicians don't want to ask patients, for example, are you having any erectile dysfunction?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing comfortable about the doctor saying, so, you know, what's the problem, Jimmy? Well, doc, I can't get it up. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, nobody wants to look at another guy or, God forbid, a female doctor and be like, you know, I'm having problems over here.
Well, it's funny. Since the introduction of Viagra, it has made for a lot of changes in the interaction between physicians and patients on this issue. So, for example, like when I'm teaching the medical students and there are certain illnesses where erectile dysfunction is very common, like I treat peripheral neuropathy and that can be associated with ED, I tell the students, you have to ask the patient if they have erectile dysfunction because they will not volunteer that information to you. If you ask, however, they're always happy to tell you the truth because they're actually relieved that they don't have to volunteer the information, that you broach the topic. It's something that they're very, very concerned about, but they don't feel comfortable bringing it up. So when you ask them, they're very relieved, but you have to ask. However, that has changed now that Viagra is on the market, because now guys will often bring it up because they want to hit you up for a prescription for Viagra.
Yeah.
The way I envision this playing out in the future, I think multiple things are going to happen. But one thing is, I think that these kind of so-called expert systems will be incorporated into medical practice because it is a way of making sure you have 100% compliance with a prescribed set of information or procedure. So computers will become very, very useful in increasing the quality and consistency of the practice in medicine.
All right. Enough about your dicks. Tell me about the Python.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So, Steve, no, I have read things about this, not recently, but...
You hit upon the word. The key word was recent, a recent study, because there were older studies. Hang on. There were older studies that suggested that the Burmese python, so that is an invasive species. It's a large python. It's wreaking havoc in the Everglades to local species. And the question is it going to remain isolated to the Everglades or is it going to spread out of it? Now, there were older studies which suggested that there was the potential for the Burmese python to spread, you know, far outside of Florida. But the most recent study showed that those older studies were wrong, that they used an incomplete climate model. And when you use a more accurate climate model where you take into consideration many more factors, and it turns out that they will remain, that this model predicts, which is a better and improved model, that they will remain in the Everglades.
See, a little knowledge can hurt you sometimes.
But no,
don't you hate that?
It's not about having a little knowledge. I had a lot of knowledge, and it's merely a matter of definitions. Steve,
but it wasn't complete.
And lying to yourself. Continue.
So the older crappy studies were trumped by the recent, more accurate studies.
Nice rainbow video, by the way, Rebecca.
Now, I specifically threw the word recent in there because I just to distinguish it from the older studies, which contradicted it. But yeah, this was a tricky one because of that very factor. It was tricky. So one other question that comes up is, well, what about global warming? You know, when the climate warms, will that expand the possible range of the Burmese python in the United States? And according to the same model, ironically, increasing CO2 in the atmosphere, despite the temperature increase, will actually reduce the range of the Burmese python, not only in South Florida, but in its native habitat. So its native range may actually be threatened.
I consider this a moral victory.
You can consider it whatever you want.
Well, congratulations, guys.
Oh, thanks, Jay.
Yeah, congratulations, Bob and Evan.
Yeah.
Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I have a quote. This is a quote from a man named Plato. Wouldn't anybody like to define Plato, or shall I do it?
Go ahead.
Dwarf
he was planet. A classical Greek philosopher who, together with his mentor,
Socrates,
and his student,
Aristotle,
correct, helped lay out the foundation of
Western civilization.
In philosophy. Pretty good, Steve. Wikipedia on wheels, Steve. I love you.
Okay, it's Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Come on.
It's philosophy 101, kids.
I actually took Greek philosophy in undergraduate school, but go ahead.
Yeah, I read
so
the books.
Who didn't?
So Plato said, "We can easily forgive a child who is afraid of the dark. The real tragedy of life is when men are afraid of the light."
I like that.
Plato.
Plato.
His last name is Plato, and his first name is Plato.
What play was his first name?
I didn't think you could do it, Jay.
Plato.
One quick announcement this week. We have the SGU Uncut #3 is up.
Hey, that's so exciting. What's on there?
It's the full 1 hour and 5 minute interview with Banachek.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, that's
so
a good
interview.
He was a talker. We couldn't shut that guy up. So,
did he talk, too?
I learned more about the Alpha Project in 1 hour with him than I ever knew in my life.
So he used about 25 or whatever so minutes of his interview in a couple weeks ago in our podcast. But that really was just a taste. There was a lot of stuff in there that
he was
we didn't have time to cover.
Incredible. Dude just, and things he's like, I probably shouldn't have said that. And we said, well, we're going to give it to 40,000 listeners now.
Right. So. Well, we're not going to give it to them.
Oh, we're going to sell it.
We're going to sell it. So the uncut is extra bonus material that we put in an uncut format. For example, the full hour and 5 minute interview with Banachek. You can get to it from the SGU website if you go to the premium content button. And this is the third episode now. So from last year's TAM, we have
Christopher Hitchens, Dirty Limericks.
Yeah, Christopher Hitchens, and filthy, dirty limericks we couldn't put in our regular podcast.
Filthy.
Awesome.
They were great.
And then extended interviews with John Rennie and Phil Plate as well.
Also filthy.
That's right. Not as filthy as Christopher Hitchens. Oh, no.
And we have more coming this
and
year.
And we have more coming. So
we have a lot of filth in the pipeline.
We have one and two from last year, and now we have #3 just going up. So check those out. These are pay per download, so $1.99 per download. This is just one of the ways that we're experimenting with to try to support all of our activities. So we appreciate you paying to download this extra content. Well, thank you all for joining me once again.
Thank you, Steve.
Our pleasure.
It was fun.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.